from Sinai to Manhattan, Class 4. Brief review before we move on and try to start applying some of the great principles we've studied. We talked about 2 weeks ago. How did the Jews in the wilderness absorb all of this information? It wasn't written down. And how did Moses give it over? Repetition. First to his brother Aaron, and then to his sons, and then to the elders, and then to the entire community. And they're just basically studying, talking it out. Moses then, of course, appoints 70 great scholars, the elders they're called, or what's the word? The Sanhedrin, the very first Sanhedrin. And in every generation, there's this group of 70 scholars that represent the entire people, and they are transmitting this oral tradition from one generation to the next. What other function? Hold on, I'm just teaching now. Can I call you in about an hour? I'm sorry. I'll call you back. Thanks, man. So, I'm sorry, I had to take that. So they passed it down from generation. What other function did the Sanhedrin serve besides transmission? They wore a couple of yarmulkes. One yarmulke was just moving it down from generation to generation. And by the way, what really transmitted the oral tradition from generation? Was it simply those 70 men? No, it was every parent that taught their child, every teacher that taught their students was transmitting it, and not simply transmitting it, but developing it. What story did I share last week that expresses that? That the Torah looks different, although it's based on the same principles that God gave her to Moses at Sinai. What was that story with the time machine? Last week it was a story, jogging your memory. Moses is what? Is sitting in whose classroom, guys?
Rabbi Akiva's
classroom. How did he get there? He traveled through teletransporter, you know. He traveled through space and time and sat 1,000 years later in Rabbi Akiva's class. And what was his experience initially? Positive or negative?
He didn't get
what was going on. Now, why didn't he get it? We explained it. Because would you understand something 1,000 years later? No, because 1,000 years of scholarship had transpired, 1,000 years of people talking about it, and their parents and their kids and the teachers and the students, and developing scholarship. But when they asked, when one student asked his Rebbe, where'd you get this from? What's the source of what you're teaching? What was his answer? Halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. Oh, that is a transmission from God to Moses on Sinai. Moshe, you know, sort of was calmed, if you will, because he understood that even though things looked and sounded different, they were all still based on the same basic principles, the same 613 mitzvot. But the way those mitzvot are going to be understood and applied is going to be different. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes when we get to the case of the Siamese twins. Anyway, that's the Sanhedrin, the Jewish High Court. If you look on page 7, this is the chain of transmission of the oral tradition from one teacher to the next. And by the way, people do this. This is real. Does anyone have a family tree here? Some people have family trees in terms of teachers, that they can actually trace their family. I told you when we had our speaker about Italian Jewish culture, she spoke here last Friday night. Welcome. I want to introduce a dear friend, Rabbi Jonathan Udrin, who was formerly an MG participant. And yeah, he hasn't left. And lives in Israel with his beautiful family and teaches at Hebrew University, runs an amazing outreach one-on-one learning program at Hebrew U.
You have the best students here.
We do. So welcome. So we're just reviewing last week's material. Now, what else? So the Sanhedrin wore a couple of yarmulkes, right? So they transmitted the oral tradition, and they also... what's that? What else did they do? What other function did the Sanhedrin have? They created laws. Now, when a rabbi creates a law, what do we call that law?
Rabbinic.
A rabbinic law, okay? But when the Sanhedrin, this is a very important distinction, when the Sanhedrin would interpret the biblical text using what? Remember those 13 fancy weird word? What was that? Hermeneutical principles. And I gave a few examples last week of a Kal V'Chomer and a Gezeirat Shavah and these different legal principles. When a member of the Sanhedrin would interpret a verse in the Bible using these 13 hermeneutical principles and arrive at an understanding, and that law became the law, is that biblical or is that rabbinic?
Biblical.
Why is it biblical?
they're just interpreting why the Torah says.
Right, because they're not making it up, as opposed to, so who can give me an example of rabbinic law versus a biblical law like that? I gave an example last week of a biblical law that wasn't passed down from generation to generation. This is the way you read it. The Sanhedrin, the men of the Sanhedrin, interpreted the biblical text using one of these 13 rabbinical principles, and pop, out comes the law. Out comes the tradition. Yeah, what was the example?
That chicken counts as meat.
So chicken is what? But that's an example of rabbinic or biblical?
That's rabbinic.
Why is that rabbinic?
Because the Torah doesn't prohibit.
Because the Torah doesn't prohibit you from mixing fowl, chicken, with meat, with milk. Only
meat.
Right? Don't mix the kid in its mother's milk. Meat. The rabbis came along and did what? I'm really sorry. The rabbis created a fence, and they were concerned if you get too used to having chicken. That's classic rabbinical. They made up a law. They were authorized to do that by the Torah itself. There's a verse in the Torah itself that authorized those rabbis and commanded us to heed their right. But what's an example of, I gave last week? So tefillin.
Because they said that in the Torah that.
What the fault?
You should write the whole thing, but then the rabbinical law really specifies the definition of
how. Not rabbinical law. The oral transmission really specifies the how,
okay.
What it looks like, black boxes, leather straps, certain parchments. But those are just transmitted. Those are transmitted. I know I'm getting really technical, but it's really good to have this down. And therefore, it's biblical, because the rabbis didn't make any of that up. It's
okay.
Not like, I think they should be black,
yes.
And I think they should be, well, let's go with black. No, that was transmitted down. But what's an example of a phrase in the Torah or a law, a mitzvah that you see when you go to a special occasion and you see the couple under the chuppah getting married in a certain kind of way? And I gave that as an example of biblical or rabbinic?
Rabbinic.
Ketubah is rabbinic, good. But that's not what marries a couple, is it?
No, when a,
no,
when
changing
a man
the
takes
rings.
A woman.
When a man takes a woman, that's the verse in the Torah, ki kach ish isha, when a man takes a woman, so then the rabbis are like, how does a man take a woman? How do two people get married?
The
wedding ring. So, but where does that come from? So that was the rabbis actually using one of the 13 hermeneutical principles called Zerat Shavah, which is, you see a word here and a word there, and they borrowed the legal definition of the word from another place, they applied it here, and that became the legal definition of marriage. So when a couple, when a man gives a woman a ring, and it's witnessed under the chuppah, and now they're married, are they married because the Torah says they're married, or because the rabbis say they're married? It's a trick question. It's the Torah, because it's based on the verse that you just quoted, Katie. Okay? Now you'll say, what do you mean? But it's the rabbis getting involved in it. But they didn't make up the verse. They wore a few hats. They can make up laws. Those are called rabbinic. An example of the chicken that you just gave is a good example of that. Or the example of muksa, right? We don't write on Shabbat, but I'm not supposed to carry around the pen because I might come to. It's like the fence kind of stuff. That's rabbinic. Everything else really is biblical. Even though the rabbis are involved, the sages are involved, but you understand why. And this is really important. There would be no human element to the Torah and to its transmission if we're simply robotically following words in the Torah. And the real question is, how do you understand those words? And that's why, and I said this 2 weeks ago, when you go to a yeshiva, a classic Jewish school, what are they spending most of their time studying? They're spending most of the time studying the Talmud, because the Talmud is really the way to unlock the secrets of the Bible, of the Torah. Without that oral transmission of how to read certain things, or when we don't have an oral transmission as to how to read it, case in point, getting married, we have the members of the Sanhedrin who then interpret the verse using one of the 13 hermeneutical principles. So I brought this up last week. So why can't you or I do that? Why can't I look at a verse in the Torah and interpret the biblical text the way I see fit? We were talking about this a little. Why? What, a bunch of guys who lived many years ago, why did they get to do it? So I gave the analogy, do we have that in our own legal system? You'd have anarchy. You'd have 60,000 different types of Judaism because everybody's doing their own thing. And we know that if you have a clause in the Constitution and you decide to interpret it one way, that's great. And another person decides to interpret it another way, that's also great. But you can't have a society that way, which is why the only people who are the final arbiters of the clauses in the Constitution are the Supreme Court. And it matters what they say and how they vote. And that's how laws are promulgated in this country, at least the ones that are consistent or not with the Constitution. Right? There has to be a legal system. You can't just have everybody and anybody saying and doing and interpreting the way they please. Now, could you be right? Maybe you're right. Maybe you're more right than the rabbis, but we need a system. And who doesn't get involved in that system? Remember the other passage in the Talmud we studied last week? God stays out, or we keep God out. On page 8 of your source sheet, there's a Gemara from Bava Metzia. We talked about that great debate between Rabbi Elazar and the sages. And every time, who wins an argument?
Majority.
The majority. So the sages, right? But Rabbi Elazar started bringing proofs from what? He's like, if I'm right, then let the walls of this Beit Midrash buckle. And what happened to the walls of the Beit Midrash? They buckled. Let the water go upstream instead of downstream. And it did. And the rabbis were like, you can't bring proofs from the waters and supernatural. And then finally God yells out and said, Rabbi Akiva's right. And what did the rabbis say to God?
Go away.
They say, Lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah is not in the heavens. They took a verse from the Torah, by the way, when they say that. You gave us the Torah to figure out. Now, I know what you're thinking. You gave us the Torah, so let me figure it out. I have to rely on a bunch of God. Again, there needs to be a system. It's like anything else. And that's why when you offer up a theory and you advance an approach to understanding something in Judaism, you want to articulate it in a way that's consistent with the system. Just like if you were a physicist or a mathematician or in any field, even in the social soft sciences, you don't just go in as a historian or a psychologist or a sociologist and just shoot from the hip. You try to ground what you're saying in research and try to follow the rules of the scholarship of whatever field that you're entering. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to get very upset when people were like, no, this is what I think. Okay, you can have your opinion, but nobody would be taken seriously in a university if somebody just walked in and defied all of the systems that have been developed by the great scholars and just said, this is the way it should be. You need to prove it, and you need to ground it in scholarship. And that's what we do when we rely on the Sanhedrin from every generation. Please, Tracy.
Because there's only a court that is of equal stature to Sanhedrin, both the world of Sanhedrin, and that doesn't exist anymore, could you not make the argument that the system is broken?
It is broken. It's called exile. Mm-hmm. It is. It is one of the, I don't want to say a punishment, but it is one of the consequences of having lost the temple. One of the things we pray in our silent devotion for every day is the restoration. When we call about the Messiah, there's about 4 or 5 expressions of the loss of our connection with God through the temple. One of which is we say, Hashiva Shaftenu Kivarishana. Please God, restore our judges. And what do we need? We have judges. No, we don't have Jewish judges. We don't have that whole system. And in a sense, I don't like to put it this way, but I do believe, to be intellectually honest, that we're stuck on a certain level with some laws. Now, this is where the conservative and the Orthodox movements sort of butt heads, because, and I don't really put the Reform in this category at all, because they don't really subscribe to the binding nature, I'm saying theologically, of mitzvot. And I described that a little last week. The Reform movement believes Judaism is more of a social force, and these are more like ideas, not things you actually have to do. So when it says you don't boil the kid in its mother's milk, it doesn't literally mean you can't eat certain foods. It just means that you have to be sensitive. That's their interpretation. Conservative and the Orthodox movements do not believe that. They believe that there's a binding nature to these mitzvot, and they actually mean things for our own personal lives. The distinction then is, what power do rabbis today have? So you just said it very nicely. We believe, when I say we, I mean that I hate saying Orthodox, because it's a Talmudic tradition. It's in the Talmud for thousands of years that if a law was promulgated by a Jewish court, a member of the Sanhedrin, you need the same stature of that court in order to change it, to amend it, or to abolish it. So in a sense, we're stuck. I always give the example of 2 days, a Yom Tov, if you're living in the diaspora. Right? Because it doesn't really apply so much today, because the calendar was based on 2 witnesses going into the court and testifying the moon was full today our calendar is based on, it's a fixed calendar. You can get your bank Lumi calendar and it'll tell you what's when in a year from now. So it doesn't seem to apply anymore, but we're really, in a sense, stuck because we don't have the legal structure. And when Jews keep a second day, I always say that's your way of showing that you have a certain allegiance and a fealty and a dedication to the system. The conservative movement believes, and I'm generalizing because there's a lot of different opinions within that movement, and it's changed a lot in the last 30 years, that there is more rabbinic authority of rabbis living today, that if there's some more compelling reason, that the rabbis can get together and change it. There really is no basis, in my opinion, to do that. Unless, again, you could somehow reconstitute the Sanhedrin. And there were attempts, modern attempts, to do that. Rabbi Steinsaltz was a part of a group of rabbinic figures who were trying to get like 70 rabbis who could be sort of representative, and it never happened. Which is another expression of living in exile. We can't really all agree on who the 70 rabbis would be. Yeah, Katie?
Maybe going a little bit on a tangent, because you just spoke about Yom Tov. I'm going to Israel for Sukkot.
Right.
Do I have to do 2 days?
This is a debate. I went with my family, and Jill and I kept 2 days, and my dad kept 1 day. Because we all asked different rabbis.
Okay.
And the rabbi I asked told me 2 days. The rabbi my father asked said 1 day.
Okay.
So it really depends.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know what? I'll tell you, because it's feeling weirder and weirder to keep 2 days in Israel, because more and more diaspora Jews are doing 1 day. Part of the reason that's changed a little is because there's been more aliyah. There's also been more people buying property in Israel. And some rabbis believe that if you own property in Israel, that gives you a little more of a nexus to the land, so you can, when in Rome, so to speak, when you're there, you do what they're doing. Or if you go 3 times a year for all the 3 festivals, Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuot, that's a very good source to also just do 1 day. And that's also changed. You know, when I grew up, if you went to Israel like once every 2 years, you were like a big shot. Now people just go all the time. Air travel has changed, you know what I mean? The economy has just changed. Everything has changed, so it seems to be changing, but the principles are remaining the same. It's the same principle. But there is a basis to say, because there is some historical evidence, that during the Second Temple era, when Jews from the diaspora would go to Israel for the holidays, it would keep 1 day. So like, why are we not doing that now? I don't know. I'm a traditionalist, and my rabbi told me you keep 2 days. He's no longer alive. My brother thinks, therefore, I can do whatever I want, but I think I'm stuck with it, in a sense. We kept 2 days, you know, when we were there. I don't know what I would say. I'd have to think about it a little more. It's a good question.
Can you be your own rabbi?
You should try not to be your own rabbi.
Yes.
Yeah, if I felt like I really knew it and I was objective, and I can, by the way, the point of this whole course and fellowships is that it's not about being a rabbi. It's about being learned for yourself. So you don't have to keep asking, nothing wrong with asking questions, but the goal is for everybody to be knowledgeable enough to be able to answer their own questions as much as we can. There will always be something, obviously. Any other questions like this? I want to apply some of this information now to a specific situation, and I want to use some of the principles that we discussed. And if you could take a look on page 10 of your handout, and before you look down, I want to give you the facts. This is a fascinating story. I am not a medical ethics professor or expert, but I did some work on this, and I've been teaching this for a couple of years. In 1977, Siamese, or the technical term, dicephalous twins were born to a Jewish family in Lakewood, New Jersey. A very religious family. And unfortunately, the children were fused in the ventral area all the way from the shoulder down to the pelvic region. And the twins were taken to the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, which is a well-known hospital, a very, very good hospital. Where, I don't know if you remember this name, C. Everest Koop. Who later became the Surgeon General during the Reagan administration, was the chief of surgery. And it became clear to Dr. Koop and to all the other doctors that were called in that both children would die unless they were separated. Now, this is such a good example because, again, if it's just about your feelings and what you think, it's a no-brainer. They're both going to die. So they were joined at the chest, and they shared the same six-chambered heart. Right? A normal heart has four chambers, but the normal four-chambered heart was fused with a stunted two-chamber heart. And the entire heart could not maintain adequate circulation for both babies. And the wall separating the basically normal four-chambered heart from the two-chambered heart was too thin to be divided. And even if they could divide it, the two-chambered heart was incapable of supporting life. There was only one solution, and that was to give the six-chambered heart to one of the two children. And again, the reason I like to share this story, although it's a heartbreaking story, is because it sort of pits up your own emotions with, like, what is the right thing to do? Because the only way to actually give that entire heart to one of the two children was to take the life of the other. Well, they're both going to die if you don't do something, so you might as well. But who's to say that you or I or any one of us have that authority to take life? And when you start getting into that question of what is the value of life, and let's say these two children could have lived for a week or a month like this, but you're now going to take away some of that time from one of the children so that the other one could live their whole life. So that would seem to make logical, reasonable sense. But is that really the ethical and moral approach to this? Is that really what God would want? Or how do you know what God wants? And by the way, that's the whole point of the Torah, is for us to know to whatever human degree is possible what the Almighty wants of us in any given situation. Now, interestingly, C.A. Everest Koop was also a religious man. He was Catholic. And he understood the tremendous ethical issues, and he was also concerned for potential homicide charges. And so he immediately referred the case to the courts. But that was very quick. There was a three-judge panel of the Philadelphia Family Court, but that said that was permission. They gave him permission to perform the procedure. But there were a number of nurses that were scheduled to assist at the operation who are practicing Catholics. And two nurses asked not to be put on the case, and three anesthesiologists also didn't want to get involved, that were being asked to help because of all the ethics and legalities. The parents of these twin girls were religiously observant Jews, I mentioned. The father himself was in rabbinical school. And so what do you do in a situation like this? I mean, if I got this question, this is way above my pay grade, who do you call? So there are people who specialize in this. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, one of the great rabbinic giants of the 20th century, he lived on the Lower East Side. He was actually very accessible. I never had the honor of meeting him, but I know I have a friend who grew up on the Lower East Side and knew him, used to pray in his synagogue, and said anytime you wanted to see Rav Moshe, you can just go talk to him. And he was just a very approachable person. He was a genius. He had like a photographic memory, and he was extraordinarily humble and sweet and kind. And he helped, spent his whole life just helping people solve very complicated problems. And Rav Moshe Feinstein ultimately decided in favor of permitting the procedure. He told the parents that they could have the surgeons perform the surgery according to Judaism, according to Jewish law. And I want to go through his reasoning with you, and I want to show you through his reasoning how a typical posek, halachic authority, or any rabbi, or yourself, please God, in a couple of weeks, will start doing this on your own to be able to actually answer a question, not simply based on what you feel. Because you got to ask yourself, what are your feelings or my feelings based on? Some good things, our parents, our professors in college, our society. But who's to say that that is somehow grounded in the divine, in something greater than a human opinion? And that's why ultimately we're trying to root everything we do in life according to the Torah, which we believe is an expression of the divine will. I want to mention before I go through Rav Moshe's reasoning that my professor and teacher, Rabbi J. David Bleich, he should live and be well. He's a rabbi on the Upper East Side. He was my professor in law school. I took him for six semesters in law school, and I also had him in rabbinical school. He's a genius of a rabbi, and he's written extensively on this topic. And he points out a dissenting opinion against which most authorities ruled. meaning that Rav Moshe's opinion was argued with by other great scholars of his stature. But what happens? You got to go to a rabbi and you got to make a decision. And you can't start shopping around. You go to your rabbi. Whatever your rabbi says, this is what you do, even if other rabbis are disagreeing. Now, the real issue here is the taking of one life, certainly to save another. It also has to be noted that Rav Moshe actually never published a written response on this. My information for tonight's class, I was able to get through an article written by Rabbi Tendler, who was one of my teachers at Yeshiva University. He was a professor. You know him?
Yeah, well, my dad knew him.
Yeah, right, so well. He's still teaching up at Yeshiva University. He's a professor of biology and ethics and a Talmud rabbi, and he's he was Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law. And he served as the go-between, because he's a doctor and a biologist, between his father-in-law, Rav Moshe, and C. Everest Koop. And he wrote this up. There's a book in the back that's got it, by Rabbi Tendler. He's a very sharp rabbinic figure. He's got an amazing sense of humor. Okay, so follow on page... Where do you go? What would you do? You're the rabbi. You get this question. Where do you go? Where do you start looking for information about taking one life to save another? That's the issue before you. The fact that it's happening through a procedure called surgery that never would have been possible with this kind of technology doesn't matter. It's you boil it down to the legal issue. And where do you go? Well, first of all, you start always where? First of all, you start in the five books. Is there a verse that applies to this? But the verses are only understood through the oral tradition, the oral transmission of the Torah, understanding that. So you go to the Talmud. Take a look on page 10 on top. There's a Mishnah, which is the black letter law that every passage of Talmud starts with. And it speaks actually about a woman having difficulty in labor. And you'll see how this applies in a moment. Follow with me. Ha'isha shi mekasha liled. This is from Ohalot, which is a part of the Mishnah, the Talmudic, in the Talmud. And a woman is having a hard time giving birth. And the commentaries explain, it's talking about a woman whose life is being threatened as she is, you know, giving birth. And a woman, by the way, as she's giving birth, has the status of a chola sheyesh bo sakana. You can do anything, you can violate the Shabbat for a woman who goes into labor. You must do that. Our first son came to us on a Shabbos, and it was Friday night. It was perfect timing because our guests were just leaving. Jill started having like contractions, and I wasn't sure, and it didn't seem so serious. So I asked my friend at the desk, concierge, and I said, "Can you just call the doctor?" I didn't want to pick up the phone. He called, and he put the doctor on the phone, and I started describing her symptoms. He's like, "Come to the hospital, and Rabbi, don't walk there." This is what he said. So I knew that, whatever. So we got in a cab on Friday night, and we went to the hospital. And by the way, I had this with this boy who was born, Yosef, 20 years ago. Had another incident with him when he was about 3. Something came crashing down on his head. He was fine in the end, thank God. But I needed to get him to the hospital really quickly. And I yelled, "Call Hatzalah." And I just yelled it to the person who was standing next to me. It happened to be Rabbi Schachter, who was the rabbi, my mentor and teacher, who was the rabbi of the Jewish Center. He just happened to be standing there. And he ran out onto West 86th Street with his talit on Shabbos, hailing a cab, because he thought it would be faster to get us than waiting for Hatzalah to come. And actually, that is the rule. Maimonides says that when you need to break the Shabbat to save a life, or even a question of a life-threatening situation, you don't look for someone else to do it. You get the biggest Torah scholar, because it's a mitzvah. So I found the biggest Torah scholar, and he held me a cab on Shabbos. And anyway, so Aisha Shimakasha Leled, a woman who's suffering and is going through a life-threatening situation when she's giving birth, it's actually permissible to abort the fetus to save the life of the mother. Why? Because her life takes precedence over the life of the child. This is where Judaism and Catholicism stand in pretty stark contrast to one another. However, the Mishnah continues, Yatsarubo, once the child's head appears, Ein nogim bo, you're not permitted to touch the child. She'ein dochin nefesh b'nei nefesh, because you're not permitted to take one life to save another. Once the child's head appears, apparently, this is the understanding of the sages, the child has some kind of independent existence on its own. And then the basic Jewish principle of not sacrificing one life to save another. And Talmud makes that pretty clear. It says that, who said that your blood was redder than his? So we know also there's a Gemara that says if someone, God forbid, tells you kill this other person, you shall be killed. To actively take the life of another human being, you're not permitted to do that. Now, there is another passage in the Talmud that talks about two people with one canteen of water, and there's only enough water in that canteen for one person to live. The person holding in possession of the canteen, it's a debate, but this is the way the Gemara comes out, is permitted to drink even though the other person will not be able to live. What's the difference between the two cases? Active versus passive. You're not actively taking the life of the other by drinking everything. I'm not saying that you can't give it over and volunteer and you wouldn't be a great saint, but you're not required to do so according to halakha. But in the other case, where someone asks you to actively take the life of another to save your own, the Talmud reasons that your blood is no redder than his, you're not permitted to do that. If you could save your own life without having to actively take, and here, this is what the doctors are being asked to do. We're not up to the babies yet, we'll come back to them. But here, when the child starts acting independently, let me just do the whole analysis, then I'll take your questions. Okay, let me just go through the whole thing, because it's a train of thought. So, and then the legal principle that ein nefesh dochin nefesh kicks into gear. And this is a Mishnah. Right now we don't really know how this applies yet. The Gemara, the Talmud, asks a question. Look at source number 2. The Gemara says the following. Itve, Rav Chisda, Rav Huna, great rabbinic figure, Rav Chisda asks Rav Huna, Yatza Rusho eino ginbo. He says, I don't understand this. The head appears, you're not allowed to touch the child, the mother, God forbid, has to lose her life, because the head has already appeared, and the legal principle of ein dochi nefesh, ne nefesh, you're not allowed to take one life to save another, kicks into gear. Lefish ein dochi nefesh, because, right, because you can't take one life to save another, v'amai. Why is that? Shouldn't it be okay still, asks the Talmud, to take the life of the baby, even though the head has appeared? Rodefu. We have another legal principle in Judaism called a rodef. And I'll talk a little more about that next week when I speak about extradition. Rodef is a pursuer. And that is a very important law and rule. It is what we call in English, in legal terms, third-party self-defense. You remember this? So you're allowed to defend yourself. Somebody comes at you, tries to kill you. What are you allowed to do, according to the law? Punch him in the face, or whatever is necessary, even lethal force. That was a little aggressive. Even lethal force to do what's necessary to defend yourself. What about a third party? I see you being chased by a third party, and I know this person is out to kill you. What is my responsibility? I have to stop the pursuer to save the pursued. Now, I have to try to use non-lethal force and do what's necessary to save you without killing him, but if the only way to stop him is lethal force, then that's permissible as well.
It's permissible or it's required?
According to Jewish law, it's required. According to American law, it's permissible. Even, and you know what's really interesting? They've extended it so much, and the Gemara says this too, it's the same in Halacha, that if a burglar enters your home in the middle of the night, and you kill him, even if it cannot be proven that the burglar had intent to kill you, you will not be prosecuted for murder. Still considered self-defense. Why? Because the assumption is that if the burglar is realized, more often than not, the burglar would defend himself from either imprisonment or harm by taking your life, and therefore you have that, you can do that. And they've actually, in more recent years, certain states have applied that to cars as well. You come in your car, somebody comes in your car, and you take his life, even if he was just trying to take your wallet, you cannot be brought up on homicide charges for taking that person's life. And it's a basic principle. It's called rodef. And it's basically self-defense projected onto a third party. In Judaism, we're more serious about it because we believe in crimes of omission, and we believe you're responsible for your fellow human being and not just for yourself.
You just said that if you're holding a whole thing of water, you give it to someone else, and it's okay because it's not active, it's passive.
Correct.
Isn't it the same thing? You're emitting help.
You're
not actively inflicting.
No, but you have a responsibility from another verse in the Torah to stop the rodef in order to save the nirdaf. And you have to take action to do that.
Right.
That's why it's just a separate principle.
Isn't it still like one life over another life?
In what case?
Because you said before that, so for the baby, once you see the head, like, who is to say that one life is more important than the other life? But isn't that the same thing?
Because you're actively taking the child's life. The mother, if she, God forbid, passes away from this situation, yes, you're not getting involved to save her life, but you're not actively taking the mother's life. Whereas the case of the child, let me just answer this thing. What was the question of the Gemara, and this will answer it. What was the question the Talmud asks now? Talmud says, I don't understand. Why does it matter if the head appears or doesn't head appear?
Because the child's out, the child's breathing.
Right, so that's what we thought. But you have this additional principle of rodef. And in this case, the baby is like a rodef. Now, I know you don't think of a baby as a rodef. Baby has no intent. The baby doesn't even know what it's doing. But the Talmud thinks, at least entertains the notion, that physically the baby is still, like, legally a rodef, even though it's not intending to do that. It's the effect is that it's taking the life of the mother, and therefore you should be able to take the life of the baby to save the mother. And the Talmud answers, no, it's different. Which I'm always looking for a better explanation of. And it says, in this case, heaven is the pursuer, because it's sort of like natural law. That's the way Rabbi Bleich, my rabbi, explained it. Now, hang on one second. Follow with me on this now. We're going to apply this to our situation before us, and then we'll answer all the questions. We're good. Rabbi Tendler explained that Rav Moshe, his father-in-law, the great rabbi, understood this to mean that while the child was within the uterine environment, the child's totally dependent on the mother. Right? That's what happens. Umbilical cord, the whole thing. So then if the child's existence threatens the mother, the child has the status of a rodef and could be sacrificed to save the life of the mother. But when the child is independent, the head appears and is able to breathe independently, and the circulatory and respiratory systems are now operating independent of the mother, the child is now considered a separate entity and treated as one. He's granted the full rights and privileges of an adult, the most basic of which is the right to life. Rav Moshe then pointed to the third source on your sheet, on the bottom, to the great Maimonides, who echoes this passage from the Talmud, that when a head appears, we can no longer intervene because the principle of not taking one life for another kicks in. And the Rambam adds the words that's not in the Talmud, "Vezehu shtivo shel olam," and this is the nature of the world. Sort of natural law, similar to what the Talmud said, heaven is the pursuer. But why is the case when the heaven appears more of natural law than when the child is in utero? Why don't we also say heaven is the pursuer when the fetus is still in utero and then not allowed to be intervened even in early pregnancy? And Rav Moshe held, and this is important, that it must therefore be the fetal status of dependency on the mother that ultimately permits the sacrifice of the child to save the mother's life. I'll say it again. It must be the fetal status of dependency on its mother that permits the sacrifice of the child to save the mother's life. And then he applied all of this to the case of the Siamese twins. The infant who only possessed the two-chambered heart, the stunted two-chambered heart, who they referred to as baby A, had no independent ability to survive on her own. Her entire survival was dependent on her twin sister, on baby B, who had the circulatory system also to back up the functioning of the heart and the liver. If Moshe asked Dr. Koop whether baby A could survive, the one with the two-chambered heart, if she received the entire six-chambered heart. And Dr. Koop said no, there was no way to save baby A. The only issue was whether both would die or baby B would be saved.
So baby B is the one with the two-chambered or the four-chambered?
No, four. Or six, depending on how you look at it. Baby A was the one with a two-chambered heart, and according to Dr. Koop, there was no way of saving Baby A's life in any event. The question is, could you intervene to save Baby B's life? In order to do that, you'd have to take Baby A's life quicker, which is tantamount to taking a life. It is taking a life, even if the life would be extinguished later. Without the attempted surgical procedure, I said, both would surely die, and there Moshe said, in halachic terminology, Baby A, the one with no independent survival, could be classified as a rodef. You follow? Why? Because what's a rodef? It's the same thing. Right? We saw from the mission, the Talmud, that it doesn't have to be a grown adult intending to take someone's life out. It could just be a child who's functioning in that way. The baby A could be classified as a rodef, as if she were pursuing her sister and threatening her life. And Rabbi Tendler says that further medical testing demonstrated this halachic dependency was in fact a relationship, the medical relationship, the biological relationship between the twins. The two-chambered heart of baby A was receiving its blood through two apertures leaking from the four-chambered heart of baby B. And but for that contribution of blood from baby B's four-chambered heart to baby A's two-chambered heart, baby A would have died in utero. And that, says Rabbi Tendler, was Rav Moshe's analysis, which served as the basis for permitting the surgery to proceed. Basically, to sum it up, since baby A was dependent on baby B, threatening baby B's life, she was equivalent to an infant in utero who is dependent on its mother's life for its survival and poses a threat to its mother's life. The Mishnah we read from the Talmud, explained by the Talmud, rules that such a fetus can be aborted under the law and rule of Rodev. Similarly, reason Rav Moshe, since baby A was dependent on baby B, threatening its life, it too had a status of a Rodev and could therefore be sacrificed to save the life of the other. Questions?
That was great. What would the scenario be if baby A and baby B both potentially could survive?
Oh, very different. Very different. And I'll tell you, I mentioned earlier, I don't know the answer to the question, but I'm going to dance around it a little. I mentioned earlier some authorities disagreed with Rav Moshe's decision on a few grounds. First, Rav Moshe's analysis assumed that one twin was dependent on the other. And there was certainly a proper assumption because Dr. Koop made that clear. But Rabbi Bleich, my teacher, points out that Koop's assertion that the four-chambered heart definitely belonged to one of the twins and not to the other is not necessarily supported by halachic evidence. The proximity of the heart to one head over the other head doesn't necessarily resolve the issue, not only halachically, but also scientifically. And he explained, and I'm going to come back to your question in a minute, that the development of the heart and the configuration of blood vessels leading to the heart are helpful in determining which of the two twins is potentially viable, but it doesn't necessarily determine which one owns the heart. Some medical experts argued that since the organ remained fused, it would be difficult to say that one baby had a normal four-chambered heart and the other one a malformed two-chambered. And therefore, before an actual division, the entire six-chambered heart would appear to belong to both, according to some. The argument is then strengthened by the fact that some experts later pointed out that in that particular case, the blood passed through a hole which was situated in a place where both hearts were fused, and also by the fact that the single six-chambered heart was supplying blood to both infants. And if it can't be established that one twin owns the heart and the other doesn't, you can't argue that one twin is threatening the life of the other. And this answers your question. You then have a situation of mutual pursuers, where each infant is threatening the life of the other. And Rabbi Akiva Eger, one of the great, more modern rabbinic figures in his comments on the tractate Ketuvot, established that in the case of mutual pursuers, the law of Rodef does not apply, and therefore any intervention would not be halachically justifiable. Rabbi Bleich goes on to say, and therefore if they both could be independent, this whole law of Rodef goes out the window, and you have no basis to perform the procedure, at least according to Rav Moshe's reasoning. Rabbi Bleich goes on to say, if it could be established that the four-chambered heart actually belonged to one of them, the halacha would be clear. The other infant would be classified as a Rodef, its life could be sacrificed to save the other. And that's actually what Koop asserted and told actually Rabbi Bleich. Rabbi Bleich spoke to the Sea Everest Coop, that the four-chambered heart definitely, quote, belongs to one of the two twins, exclusively. And it was based on that that Rav Moshe Paskin, the procedure was permissible. But there were, and there continues to be, literature coming out on this where people disagree. So I think it would change if they both had viable lives without the other. Yes?
So, in three, for on the Maimonides Rambam piece.
Yeah.
So, the negative mitzvot is, I guess, it's I guess, pursuing the life of the Rodef. So then, in this case, then, what is the positive mitzvot?
What do you mean the negative mitzvot? What do you mean?
So, like, a negative...
It's actually a positive mitzvot to take out, to stop the pursuer from chasing the pursuit. It's a positive, it's one of the 613 mitzvot.
So then why are they saying then one of the negative mitzvot, like when they talk about it in the article, why are they saying then one of the mitzvot, one of the negative mitzvot is that? I found that to be confusing when I was reading
it. Oh.
Because I wouldn't think that to be a negative mitzvot.
Because it's a not. Because it's a not. It's interesting, it's the way it's phrased. There are 613 mitzvot, 248 of which are positive,
right.
Are, you know, dues. And then there are 365 don'ts.
Right.
So the reason is because you're not supposed to take pity on the life of the Rodef. So the way the Torah phrases it, it's not kill the Rodef, it's not to take pity.
I see.
So that's why. It's just technical thing.
Okay, I see.
Great. There were some other questions here. Katie, yeah.
When you say when the head appears,
yeah.
Does that refer to crowning or actually just when
I don't know.
The head is out? Because you said then you're breathing.
No, I think it's not crowning. I think when the head is out.
Okay.
The child, because the whole basis for that, it's not like a hocus-pocus Kabbalistic thing. It's like the child is independent.
Okay.
That's why what happens when a baby comes out, they classically hit the baby because they want to get the baby breathing on its own and being independent. And that's what automatically is supposed to happen when the head appears. That's at least, you know, it's interesting, you know, how much did the rabbis, when they, you know, wrote the Talmud, know about independent functioning of babies? Because right? We know, and I don't think you have to believe that the rabbis knew everything about medicine. I don't think they did. Maimonides was a great doctor, but he lived in the 1100s, 1200s, and he said all sorts of weird stuff that most doctors would look at and go, but it was the medicine of his, I mean, he was cutting edge, but, you know, for medieval times, he was cutting edge. You know, they were bloodletting still in those days. You know, but the rabbis in the Talmud seem pretty confident that once the head appears. But I wouldn't. I think the head. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Question. We have a physician. If you want to weigh in on any of this.
Would Rav Moshe's Pesach be considered
according to Torah law? It's Torah law. I mean, look. Yeah, it's Torah law. All these things are Torah principles. Taking a life is biblical. Rodef is biblical. So, but again, don't get confused by this. Just because something is in the Talmud and actually transcribed by a rabbi doesn't make it rabbinic. It's about the issue. What's the issue you're discussing? Are you discussing muksa? Carrying around objects as a fence so you don't come to use them on Shabbat? Then it's rabbinic. If the issue is eating chicken versus meat, that's rabbinic. But if the issue is murder, taking a life, that's biblical. Now, how do you know? The more Torah you study, the more you're going to know what's in the Torah and what the rabbis made up, what the rabbis created fences for. So it has nothing to do where it's found, who said it. The rabbis are always talking about stuff. Some of the stuff they talk about is biblical, and some of the stuff they talk about is rabbinic. People get confused. Oh, a rabbi said it. Must be rabbinic, because a rabbi said it. But if the rabbi is talking about not taking God's name in vain, or observing the Sabbath, or honoring parents, and those are all biblical laws, it's biblical. That's what I want to get you guys comfortable with. Okay, it's important, because there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah. Is the oral Torah biblical? I mean, the oral law that was not transcribed onto rabbi.
It depends what it's describing. The oral Torah encompasses both biblical and rabbinic. It contains transmissions of understanding of the biblical text, and that part of the oral Torah has a biblical status. And it also contains laws and rules the rabbis made up as a fence to protect from the laws of the Torah from being violated. And that part of the oral tradition is rabbinic. It just depends what you're talking about.
So the description of tefillin, that's all oral, but that's...
But it's considered biblical because
right.
It's dealing with tefillin.
Right.
Now, there might be certain things in tefillin that might be tacked on or added or understood that's rabbinic, But the basics are biblical. And by the way, you have this with every mitzvah. Shabbat has a lot of stuff that's biblical and some stuff that's rabbinic. Kashrut has some stuff that's biblical and some stuff that's rabbinic. Shalom Aleichem. Welcome. Yes, question. We're finishing up, Rabbi Ezra.
You're amazing.
No, you're amazing.
Do you think this case would have at all been different if it was in Israel versus here in America?
No.
No?
It all comes down to who the rabbi you ask the question to. It really, you think about it, you go to Rabbi A, he says this, you go to Rabbi B, he says that, it could be a life and death difference.
Shouldn't you think about the majority? Isn't that a Torah principle?
We don't create that. We don't have a Sanhedrin that does that anymore. That's a good point. You know, why don't I go to 10 rabbis and I'll do what 6 of them say? Right? It's an interesting suggestion. You know, it's okay, by the way, because, you know, there are specialists. And it's a good thing to consult someone who's really a specialist in that area, because you get maybe a better opinion, because there's more scholarship. You know, the person knows more in that area. But the ethics of the fathers, the Pirkei Avot says, "Aseh lecha rav." The rabbis say, "Make yourself a rabbi. Have a one consistent go-to rabbinic person. That's the ideal." Yeah.
What about like the Beit Din? Would there be any case like this if you would go to Beit Din?
So Beit Din's today, you mean? Because today's Beit Dins are not yesterday's Beit Dins.
What's a
Beit Din? A Beit Din is just a Jewish court. Now, No, I think it's the same thing here and there. Israel, you're supposed to try when you're in a dispute, a monetary or other kind of dispute, where a Jewish court can have jurisdiction. When it comes to a crime, Jewish courts have no jurisdiction. You're going to have to go to the secular court. There's no enforceability. We don't have a police force. We can't put you in jail. We can't freeze your assets. So going to a 3 rabbis is very nice, but it's not going to do anything.
What if it's a Torah provision, like idolatry or something?
Well, they don't have the power to...
They're going
to
throw you in jail. You're going to go to a rabbi and ask them, hey, can I kneel down to an idol?
You don't have to go to Beit Din for... You go to a rabbi for an opinion. The only times Beit Dins work today is if you have a financial dispute with a fellow Jew, and you should try ideally to actually go to a Jewish court before a secular court. It's considered a little of a slap in the face in the Torah to go first to a secular court, because we have a whole legal system. By the way, guess where much of the laws of the secular legal system come from? A lot of them are from the Torah. So you should try. Now, the problem is that sometimes those courts don't have the level of enforceability, or they... So if you are being sued by a fellow Jew, or you want to sue a fellow Jew, I know this is going to sound strange, you should try to first take them to a Jewish court. It's also nicer. You'll save a lot of money. You don't need a lawyer. You don't need a lawyer. You just go to the court and say, and tell them what it is, and the other person tells them, and then they resolve the dispute based on Torah and rabbinic law.
I heard there's a lot of corruption with that.
There is some corruption.
Yeah.
You have to go to a Jewish court that has a good reputation. I don't know if there's a lot, but there's some, and I know some of that exists, unfortunately. So like anything else, you want a recommendation. But let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, because there are a couple of bad apples. It's still a very beautiful thing, and I'll tell you, it's also a nicer... You know, I've done this where I've had a dispute with someone. I'll say, why don't we go to a Beit Din? Because no one's going to write an article about it. It's not going to be out there. No one's going to have to spend any money. We can find out what these 3 great rabbis have to say about our dispute. Sometimes you can actually choose one of them, where one litigant chooses one, the other litigant chooses the other, and then the 2 together choose a 3rd. Or the 3rd gets chosen randomly or something like that. It's not done that often, but it can be done. And I would encourage it. You'll save a lot of money. I'll tell you what I really encourage. I have a friend who I went to law school and rabbinical school with, my friend Adam Berner, and he has devoted his life to mediation and arbitration for couples that are getting divorced. And he is saving, forget the money, because the money is like ridiculous, how much money is being spent and thrown out, but how many years of people's good lives are being wasted fighting each other. And mediation and arbitration is a way around that. And I really encourage couples who are going through serious issues And he sometimes helped reconcile the couples too. Divorce lawyers are just trying to get money for their clients. I'm not saying anything, and sometimes comes to that, and some people just won't have it in the way. They want to kill each other in court, and they want to spend a lot of money doing it. And that's what happens, and we have a beautiful system to take advantage of that. But there is a much better way around that, of course. I want to finish up. Rabbi Ezra's waiting. The most important thing from this class, by the way, let me finish. What happened with the babies? They performed the procedure, and they saved baby B's life. Unfortunately, about 40 days later, baby B died for due to other complications having nothing to do with the surgery. And it was a very, very sad situation. But I share it with you, not to depress you, but I want you to see that Torah law is dynamic and it's real, it's relevant. There is no situation that cannot be analyzed according to the principles of Judaism. And if we can't, it's because we have failed to find the principles. They're there. There's a beautiful passage in the Ethics of our Fathers, Hafochba v'Hafochba. Turn it over and turn it over. If you keep turning the Torah around and you dig deep enough, you will find an answer and an approach for any problem. And it goes back to our original class. Most people say, well, that's impossible. There's no electricity when the rabbis wrote the Talmud. But the Talmud was just passed down of the oral tradition. We believe ultimately the stuff comes from a higher place that is not bound by time and space. And if it's not bound by time and space, then electricity and Siamese twins and all sorts of fertility and other types of things are all part of the system. And it's because there's something beyond the human here. It's not simply a bunch of people who can only see this far into the future. It's the Almighty that we believe has given us the system and given us a lot of leeway to interpret it and to arrive at decisions. I'll stick around for a few minutes after class, but I don't want to go any longer. I will try to send homework this week. I apologize. And I'm sorry also, I think I sent out the wrong class a few weeks ago and somebody caught me on that.
Wow.
Have a great night, everyone. We'll see you on Shabbat. By the way, Ruthie is back. And Ruthie is going to be speaking on Shabbat, and I'll be doing Cafe Connect.